Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast with me, your host, Justin Chisholm. My guest this time is New Zealand solo ocean race skipper Conrad Coleman. Conrad is probably best known for his participation in the last Vendée Globe, when, despite being dismasted with fewer than 1,000 miles to go, he jury-rigged his stricken boat and made it to the finish line in Le Sable d'Olonne. In doing so, he became the first person to complete the race using only renewable energy sources like hydro and solar power. Now Conrad is back and he's hoping to take another crack at the Vendée Globe next year, and he's partnered with British renewable energy company Ethical Power to help him get to the start line. I spoke to Conrad on Skype from his home in Lorient, France, a few days after he'd completed a very different kind of single-handed race, the French solo Matricoque, aboard one of the new Beneteau Figaro 3 semi-foiling monohulls. Conrad Coleman, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. I suspect you must be feeling a little bit jaded. You've just come back from some solo sailing on the Figaro circuit. Let's start by talking about that. Which race were you doing, and how did it go?
I was doing, first off, thank you. It's nice to be here, and it's cool to have this opportunity to talk with you about my various projects and adventures and misadventures. And certainly the solo Matricoque, the name of the solo race that I just did, was more of a misadventure than other ones. I have become an absolute offshore specialist, and particularly in the solo sector, since I started my career back in 2008. And thus, I'm a lot more comfortable when the upwind market is sort of 3,000 miles away than I am when it's 3 miles away. And it's been a real challenge. I've never done the Figaro before, despite often it's seen as a stepping stone to the Vendée Globe, but like most things in my life, I do things backwards. So three races around the world, including the Vendée Globe, I've never done the Figaro, and thus I'm needing to sort of relearn not only solo sailing, but also sort of more short level and high intensity regatta style sailing. And so it's a pretty brutal and steep learning curve, but it's going well.
So why are you putting yourself through the trauma of this Figaro circuit? Because you're up against some of the top French names in the business, aren't you? Everybody seems to have flocked to this fleet. I mean, Loic Perron is sailing them, Charles Caudrelier is sailing them, Armel Lecléache is sailing them. So it's not as if you're up against any rabbits in that fleet. So what's the idea of joining that class?
Well, yeah, you're exactly right, and it's quite disorientating actually to be in this fleet, because wherever you look, you cited some names. We've also got Michel Desjoyeaux, who's won won the Figaro three times, won the Vendée Globe twice, and I remember at the end of the 340-mile solo leg that we did the other day, I felt like I was way out the back and having a terrible time, and I looked over, and I've got Michel Desjoyeaux next to me. And so clearly, it's a pretty humbling experience for everybody, even for the old dogs that are the real legends in the sport. And it's tricky to go and pick your side when you're doing an upwind beat, because on one side you've got Jan Elias and a bunch of other hotshots, and then on the other side you've got Armel Lecléache, and you're like, well, I've got two of the best sailors in the world right here, and they can't decide which side is the favored one. So as to the rest of us, then it sort of leaves it more to chance. But as to why I'm doing this, it's one of it is sort of knocking the rust off, because I haven't done any solo sailing since the end of the last Vendée Globe, because I came and worked as a journalist for the Volvo Ocean Race, and then I've been hard at work behind the scenes putting together the new Vendée Globe campaign. So with my partner, Ethical Power, which is a British-based solar park manufacturer and energy supplier, we decided that it would be good for everybody to sort of get back up to speed. So they're new in this space as a sponsor and wanted to see what it was like, and wanted to get their team up to speed on what this looks like. I needed some time to warm up for the Vendée Globe next year. And And then also, it's a great opportunity to learn. I at the very beginning of the season, I said that that this was going to be all about learning, all about sort of going back and filling in the gaps in my career that I had jumped over in my haste to get to the Vendée Globe. And so I'm going back to school, and I'm getting schooled. But
yeah, I'm fascinated by the contrast between, as you say, those big open ocean legs that you can you know get yourself kind of, I'm gonna use the phrase settled in, I'm sure that's not the right phrase, as compared to this much shorter Figaro style of racing, where I guess you're getting very little sleep on these Figaro races. To just kind of contrast the two boats a little bit and the style of sailing for us, if you could.
Yeah, well, it's very, very different. And just to go back to what you said earlier about why everybody's coming back into the Figaro fleet. First off, it's the 50th anniversary of the class, and also it's the first year of the Figaro 3. And so they've gone to a more modern boat with asymmetrical sails and a bowsprit, and then sort of foils, which are more of a distraction in the marketing exercise than an actual performance gain. But it's exciting to get stuck in. And the boat is very small, sort of nine meters. And I know that they can sound like you've got lots to go on with, because you've got running backstays and often multiple head sails and spinnakers and foils to adjust in their rake and so on. So it's a relatively complicated boat to deal with, and particularly so early in the cycle that we're constantly adjusting everything to try and find the key to success with the class. But then crucially, the boat doesn't have a great deal of inertia. It's very light. It doesn't have any water ballast, and the pilot is not so sophisticated. And so with a very sensitive boat, with not a great pilot, you need to drive it all the time. And so if you were going upwind or downwind in VMG mode, then there's basically no excuse. You have to be at the helm. Otherwise, the speed can drop off. You can lose 20% by putting the pilot on, which means that you can only really sleep when the boat is set up well or when you're on a reach. So, for example, this last race that I did, which was 48 hours long and 340 miles, I slept for 2 hours, from talking with the other sailors, that seems like a pretty good average. So it's brutal. But it is an absolute sprint. Whereas the races that I've become more used to, these sort of longer transatlantics or round the world races, then it's an entirely different mindset. You cannot put yourself in the red zone. You cannot burn yourself up, because you know that you're going to need to sail tomorrow, the next day, and in 3 weeks' time with the same degree of intensity as you do today. And so it's a very, very different mindset. And then thankfully, even though the loads are a lot higher, the boat, you know, the sails are 360 square meters instead of 80, you've got help in the sense that the boat is very well conceived. You've got a pedestal, and so you can apply your power in a really efficient manner. You've got a pilot that drives better than 99% of sailors out there, certainly after 3 hours. And so it's a very different mindset. In one case, you're sort of the master of ceremony and dealing, trying to coordinate lots of different elements on the bigger boat. And on the smaller boat, it is absolutely like sailing a dinghy, but for doing it 3 days straight.
And how have you approached this challenge of taking on the Figaro? Because as you say, there's a lot going on in a short space of time. There's foils, there's running backstays, there's asymmetric sail trim and changing sails as well. Have you had any kind of coaching input from any of the experts on this, or have you pretty much just taken it on yourself?
Well, the thing that's interesting is, because this is the new fleet, even the rock stars don't have all the answers. And so it's pretty interesting going and having a chat with people like Jan Elias, for example, who has won this race 3 times, and he doesn't have all the answers, and is quite happy to say so. So there are various training groups spread out along the French coast. The most significant one is a little bit north of me in Port La Fleurée, the Port de Course au Large, that's based there. I live in Lorient, and we've got depends on the day, but 10 to 15 boats here that will go out and do training days as well. And then there's another one in Sanjid Kwalvi, which is down in the Bondi region, close to the home of Benetton. So these three centers are all sort of furiously running around trying to figure out how to make these boats go.
So, Conrad, you're probably best known for your Vendée Globe exploits last time around, and primarily, as much as it was, it's always an achievement just to get around and to get into that race and complete a lap of the world, but you did it without only using renewable energy sources. So that's a really easy phrase that rolls off the tongue, and But I think it's be interesting for us to look at the significance of that. What does that mean to a Vendée Globe skipper? So, you know, how was your boat set up differently to the others? And what were some of the challenges that you face when you're not using fossil fuels on a race like the Vendée Globe?
Sure. Well, just briefly to intro that, I want to talk about the philosophy behind it, because I had a very small budget and not a great deal of time to repair the boat. And so it was ambitious of me to rip out the diesel engine and replace it with the electric motor and a renewable energy system. But I wanted the boat to be a reflection of my own personal values, and also for that project, for the Vendée Globe project, to, in my own little way, try and demonstrate that renewables are the future, and that the Vendée Globe can be so much more than sport. And certainly we saw that in the last Volvo Ocean Race with Turn the Tide on Plastic, and more people using the platform of ocean racing to not only talk about racing in its pure sense, but also to engage the public in a really important conversation. So that's what I was trying to do. And that is what led me to be working with my current sponsor, Ethical Power, a solar installer. And also that is the red line through my current project, and that is that we're currently talking to new sponsors to go again around the world in the Vendée Globe and hopefully the ocean race. And we're only discussing the prospect of a partnership with companies that have committed to going 100% renewable in their own business. And so it's pretty interesting being selective in that way. But then in terms of the installation on the boat, I mentioned just now, I ripped out the standard diesel engine, which is used for going in and out of port in the normal life of the boat, but then is sealed during the race. And so the engine can run to charge the batteries, and most boats will do that twice a day, but it cannot be engaged to propel the boat forwards. So that out electric motor in, produced by the company from Finland called Ocean Vault, and Ocean Vault is now working with Alec Thompson on the their new boat, which I think is going to be launched in a couple of months. And so I'm, delighted to see other competitors picking up the technology that I helped to demonstrate in the last one. And then I cover the boat with solar panels on the roof, and then also trialed some prototype thin film solar panels in the mainsail. That didn't turn out to be a great option because they filled up with water relatively quickly, and it turns out that trying to service solar panels that are 18 meters above your head is a sort of tricky proposition. So I think going forward, solar panels on the roof and on the deck is a much better way forward. But crucially, the electric motor that I installed operates as a hydro generator. So in the solo offshore world since 2014 or so is when the systems were validated, there's been a company called Wattensea down at La Rochelle here in France that builds these little propellers that drop down off the transom. And then as the boat charges forward, then you spin their little propeller, and much like the small help me out here, Justin. The little small wheels that go onto that clip onto a bicycle wheel that charge.
I know exactly what you mean. I don't know what they're called.
Yeah. Anyway, so same kind
dynamo,
of idea.
Dynamo.
You're harvesting. Yeah, exactly, like a dynamo. So you're harvesting sort of this sort of parasitic power, and so that's become standard issue across our fleet. both in Mocha and Class 40. And I decided to take it a step forward by actually putting a massive hydro generator in place of the diesel engine. And so for the same boat speed, I was able to produce 10 times the power of these little units on the transom by running the primary electric motor of the boat backwards and charging it that way. So it's an incredibly reliable system because it's using a much bigger propeller. It's tucked in just behind the keel, and so it's well protected, and it's a system that works really well in cruising boats and racing boats.
And you're confident in that system now. When you started the Vendée Globe, were you as confident?
Yes, because I had done two transatlantic races using the system beforehand, and I know it's a little strange to talk about two transats as a warm up, but that's what we do on these fast boats that can rip around the world, where a transat takes 10 days or 2 weeks, and one of the advantages that I saw was that I had a much greater capacity to store energy than most boats, because without the weighted diesel engine, I replaced that weight in essence with lithium ion batteries, and I felt free and confident in the system because I could run all of the electrical systems on board the boat, the autopilot, the water maker, the canting keel, the satcoms, the instruments, for almost a week just on battery power alone. Whereas my competitors were constantly sailing the boat with one eye on the battery motor and having to charge twice a day. And so pilots and sailors should be talking about it this way, but pilots talk about load shedding, which is when you give one person too many tasks for them to juggle at one time, then load shedding kicks in and you just start dropping tasks, you know, and you cannot physically or mentally deal with so many competing interests for your time. And one example of that in sailing was 4 years ago at the start of the Route du Rhum in 2014. Thomas Colville had his new Sodebo, and he was charging down the Brittany coast. I think that he was fighting for the lead with Loic Perron on Banque Populaire with their big 30-meter-long trimarans. And he saw that there was a target on AIS and thought he had time to run down and start the engine and give his battery the charge, but before he had to negotiate the challenging cross with a cargo ship. It took him a little bit longer than anticipated to get the engine started, and during that time he had a collision at sea at I think 20 knots of boat speed with a cargo ship. And so that broke his boat and it put him out of the race, all because he was focused on another task. Whereas I never had that degree of urgency to charge the batteries because I had so much stored energy. And so I found this very free and very liberating, and added another strategic element to my race because I was not only forecasting and doing weather analysis and routing to make the boat go fast, but I could pick and choose with several days advance as to when I was going to charge my batteries next, because when the boat was going to be going fast again. Huh.
That's really cool, because I was expecting you to talk about the challenges of running on renewable energy, and in fact, what you're doing is telling me about the benefits of running on it from a racing point of view, not just from a an ecological point of view. So that's pretty interesting.
For me, there's really no downside. That it's philosophically, everybody should be doing that way. In many ways, the sailing community sort of hides behind its green credentials a little bit by saying we're pushed by the wind, and that's absolutely true. But there's so much more that should be done by sailors. We all have a very intimate and sincere relationship with the natural environment around us, and I think that everybody should be making steps to lighten their impact in many, many ways. And in terms of weight, which is, you know, it's not just top models that freak out about their weight. It's sailors more than actually. And And so in terms of weight, it's competitive, and in terms of drag, it's competitive as well, because in any case, with a conventional installation, you still have the propeller in the water and you're not allowed to use it. And so I think there's only benefits into the system.
So you've proved that it can be done, proved that it can be done comfortably. And now, as you mentioned, we're seeing the take up in the rest of the Vendée fleet. Have you, people like Alex Thompson you mentioned earlier, have you got any feel for what percentage of the fleet might be using renewable power this time around, for this next edition of the race in 2020?
It could be as high as 5 boats out of 30, so it's pretty good. I was the vanguard with 1 out of 30 last time, and so if I've shown the way and other people are coming in behind me, then I think that's fantastic. I absolutely do not want to maintain exclusivity onto that. The more people that adopt this, the better.
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, and you know, I think we'll also see this. You know, some of the conversations I've been having with prospective Volvo Ocean Race teams, this theme comes up there as well. Do you think it's practical for a fully crewed boat to be doing the same thing?
Yes, I do. I do absolutely. Boats make a lot of noise, particularly crewed boats when they're sailing, and so I'm sure that the off watch would be happy to be to do away with the diesel generator running while they're trying to sleep. But over and above that, again, as I said, the drag is not significant, the weight is not significant, and having worked in the Volvo Ocean Race or the Ocean Race media team, I know just how much content comes back off the boats and how much how frequently the connection is made with the satellite system, and that really pumps the power. In many cases, the media desk and sending images and video and live streams is more power than actually running the rest of the boat. Mm-hmm. And so it's absolutely essential for this race that continues, that we continue to have this this live connection with the boat. That's what adds value to the sponsors and the race, and allows us to have such a great interaction with the fans. And so even if you're not running an autopilot on board the boats, then you've still got all of these other systems that are running. So you know, these boats are like an office block at sea in terms of their power consumption, and that should be generated in the best way possible.
So tell me a bit about this relationship now with Ethical Power. How long have you been talking with these guys, and just how good a match is it for you guys? It sounds like, just looking at the names, it sounds like the perfect match. And from what I read in your press release, it seems like you are on the same page with them. But tell us a bit about the relationship.
Very definitely. Well, it is absolutely a match made in heaven, that it is a company based in Exeter in the southwest of the UK, and they convert fields, green fields or brown fields or suboptimal areas into solar farms. And so they recently won some awards for putting solar panels on top of a decommissioned landfill, which was the first worldwide. And so it's really an opportunity for us to build a modern grid and a modern infrastructure on top of the the sort of detritus of the last model. And so this is a company that's incredibly motivated, both by the business opportunities of this new world, and also the philosophy behind having the smallest impact possible. The whole company is really excited by sailing and by this project. The founder and CEO, Tom Neen, is a keen sailor himself, and thus, as a client of my previous sponsor, Foresight, the Foresight Group, which is a financial company that works in the renewable sector. He sort of watched me as a Foresight boat doing the last Vendée Globe, and we met up at a function shortly afterwards. And said, I think that working together, we can probably do it better. And so it's been a great collaboration. And as I said, we've been going and targeting other companies that are either in renewables or have made the commitment to renewables. And so from A to B, our objective is to become one of the most sustainable mechanical sporting teams in the world. So it's not just pretty pictures and a few solar panels here and there. Our goal is to demonstrate to the sailing world and indeed the racing world at large how little of an impact we can make from A to B.
Sounds fantastic. So where are you up to with the progress towards the next Vendée Globe? I'm sure you would have loved to be sitting here telling me that your new boat is about to be launched, but I suspect that's not the case. So what's the plan? What's the roadmap now?
Well, the selection and qualification procedure for the Vendée Globe is a little bit tricky, and actually the race is almost a victim of its own success in the sense that there's a very good chance the race will be oversubscribed. The race is capped at 30 boats currently because the port in the Sutherland just cannot absorb that many race boats, but we'll see if we can and modify that to bring in more entries. Just imagine, Justin, the logistical nightmare of taking in monohulls that are 18 meters long, but now increasingly with all of the foils and fancy gubbins that we're sticking on the side, up to 11 meters in width. So it's pretty tricky because more and more boats want to come, and the boats that are coming are taking up more and more space.
Yeah, I've been to several Vendée Globe starts, and to say that they cram the boats and the people into that is an understatement. There's no room to spare at all, I would say.
Yeah, indeed, it's quite the event. So which is great because everybody wants to come, both on the fans and also on the competitor side. So I've got a bit of a golden ticket because I finished the last race, and in the selection procedure that we came up with, it means that I have a reserved spot at least up until the 1st of September this year to get on that start line. So that's pretty valuable given the current spate of interest. So I just got back from talks with an existing ocean race team within Amoca, and we're in talks as to whether we can team up and put our resources together so that I do the Vendée Globe and then the team goes on having validated the boat to go and do the ocean race. So it's still early days in those conversations, but it's a great opportunity to reinforce the team with an existing one, reinforce my team with an existing crewed campaign. And I think it would be an exciting opportunity to try and really marry these two worlds of solo ocean racing and the ocean race, which is being done naturally with the adoption of the Amoca 60 class for the ocean race trophy. But then the idea of having one campaign that bridges the two events would be pretty exciting as well. So stay tuned. I hope to be able to announce something shortly.
Wow, that is very exciting, and I'm desperate to know who that team might be, but I'm not going to push you because I'm sure that's at a sensitive stage. But it is interesting, isn't it, this idea of having teams that can operate across a couple of events like this, and we now have that opportunity with Amoca 60s being used in both fleets. And do you think that after this next Vendée Globe and after the following year we have the Volvo Ocean Race, there'll actually be more opportunity for that, I think, then as well? Because right now I think the people who are designing new Amoca 60s are designing them either for the Ocean Race or for the Vendée Globe. But maybe once those boats are in existence in future editions of both races, there'll be more crossover and we'll see teams competing in both.
Well, I certainly hope so. And for me, it's an exciting proposition because I've been a bit of an odd duck these past few years, but as an English-speaking sailor in the French world. And I got into sailing because I fell in love with it, with the Vendée Globe, and also with these incredible boats and the idea of sailing solo. And so I chopped in my previous job, my previous life, and moved to Europe and built my whole new life around the idea of sailing these boats. And so I've been trying to bring the rest of the world with me and create a sort of a window of entry to try and tell the story of the races and of the people behind them and of these incredible boats. And so to have the English-speaking world come towards the French this way I think it's absolutely fantastic. It's long overdue, but then also it's been pretty interesting because there's a very different culture on one side, because in the typically in the Volvo Ocean Race, you've got boats that are built and they have a competitive life of 9 months maybe, and then they sort of get sold on, whereas an Imoca 60 has a long competitive life. And so again, as somebody who's interested in sustainability, I'm really really proud of that. And and indeed, in 2004, the Vendée Globe was won by the same boat that won the race in 2000. And so it is possible for these new boats to be threatened by the existing fleet. And indeed, as I watch now, Sam Davies has a boat from 2012, and she is currently in second place in the Bermuda 1000 race. And so having updated her boat with the new incredible foils.
Gigantic. I think that we're, gigantic foils, right?
Gigantic, yeah, absolutely amazing. I think that we will see these boats continuing to live on, because almost the hull just becomes something that you stick wings to, and is actually the foils the foils and the sails that swim and speed a lot more than the actual hull. And so I think this is an incredible opportunity to marry these two worlds together. We've got some America's Cup engineers and naval architects who are dipping their toes into it, looking at what foils can do offshore, and it's great to be able to both extend the competitive life of existing boats, but also add value to a racing campaign over several key pinnacle events with the Volvo Ocean Race and or the Ocean Race and the Vendée Globe. These campaigns are not getting cheaper because the technology is ever more developed, and so we need to find these other avenues to add value to these campaigns.
We've seen some amazing images and videos of the new Imoca 60 designs. I'm thinking of boats like Chiral, which, you know, has blown a few minds around the world, including mine, when I first saw them. When you look at those boats now, and you know, with your experience of completing the Vendée Globe, how does it make you feel? Does that proposition appeal to you, those sort of boats, or does it terrify you?
Oh, very appealing, very appealing. If you remember, 10, 11 years ago, I changed my life completely because I was excited about the boats of the 2000, 2004 generation. I think that that these boats are so exciting that you know, young boys and girls are not going to have Ferraris and Lamborghinis on their walls. They're going to have posters of these crazy boats. So they are absolutely the testament of high technology and the ability to go consistently more than wind speed is just absolutely remarkable. That I've been out sailing and had Chiral do laps around me when I've been on the smaller boat, or you see them on AIS, and wind speed is, I hope I'm not giving away too many secrets here, but you know, wind speed can be 22 knots and they're doing 32. So yeah, it's pretty astonishing.
It is, I'm as you're saying that, I'm just wondering about your renewable energy source. Does things have to change when you've got a boat that's not as displacement as it was before?
No, I mean, I accused the Figaro class of having foils as a marketing exercise, and that's certainly the case. You do get a massive speed increase, as we've seen in the Imoca boats in the 60-foot class, by putting foils on. But the rules as they currently stand mean that you cannot have T-rudders or you cannot have any lifting surface on the rudders. And so you're building the hull around the idea that you're trying to diminish the drag out of the bow, and half the time it's going to be up out of the water anyway, being sustained by the lift of the foil. And so the boat is resting on a planing surface at the back of the hull, and then the lift being generated by both the keel fin and then to windward, and then the foil to leeward. So the boat is still very much in the water, although it's becoming more like a skipping stone than anything that we've seen before in a displacement mode. So Still, the idea of using hydro generators is still a very, very valid option, and indeed increasingly so, because the power that you can generate sort of increases with the square of the velocity. And so if you're going faster, then you're generating more power with the tiny propeller in the back. So I think that a boat going fast is one that can be easily converted to be renewable.
So just to round off our conversation, Conrad, you've explained to us the situation you're in. You've got some negotiations going on, potentially with a team, with an Amoca 60, to do some sharing of that resource. From a funding point of view, where are you up to? Are you funded now, or are you still very much looking for people to talk to about money for the next Vendée Globe?
No, still very, very motivated to find new partners. And I think that that we have a pretty competitive package, because we've got potentially a great boat. We've got a great team already that we've built up around ethical power. And as somebody who's done three races around the world and also worked in the past year as a journalist translating sailing into English, and I can also do that from English into French, then I think we've got a pretty good package. So keen to talk to anybody who's motivated.
I'm sure you are. And I guess my final question is, I guess now it's back to the Figaro. What have you got for the rest of the Figaro circuit this year? What's coming up for you?
Well, time flies, even if the boat doesn't yet. and so we've got we've got the start of the Solitaire de Figaro in 3 weeks' time, and so that is the premier event of the year. It has all been building up to this event, and so the Solitaire, as I said, it's the 50th edition. It is a keystone of the French sailing culture. And there've always been a few sort of scrappy Brits or international sailors in there, and that's the case here. We've got a number of British and Irish sailors, and I'm there from New Zealand, and we're all pretty motivated about telling our story and trying to bring the rest of the world into us. And so, the Solitaire, in summary, is a tour of northern France and the Western Approaches in four stages. So, stage one, it goes from Nantes. And up to Kinsale, so from southern Brittany up and around the corner into Ireland. The next leg is a bit of a doozy, and it's going to be quite interesting. It goes up through the Irish Sea from Kinsale around the Isle of Man and then down to Brittany, a town called Roscoff. The next leg, it's going to be a tricky one. It goes from Roscoff to Roscoff, but via the Brittany coast, Wolf Rock, Land's End, and also the Bay of Plymouth. And then the fourth leg goes from Brittany to Normandy along the English coast via the Isle of Wight. And so plenty of opportunities for people to follow along. There are going to be lots of snakes and ladders along the way, and lots of opportunities to win and lose crucial miles. And I will be producing a series of videos along the way to try and bring English-speaking fans along with me. So I've adopted a little bit of the raw philosophy of the Volvo Ocean Race ethos, and so I'm both be producing videos that are sort of polished with music and all the rest of it, as well as putting uncut, unedited segments of the race and what it looks like to give people a skipper's perspective of what this incredibly competitive race looks like.
I think that's fantastic. And Conrad, I wish you the very best of luck with that race, and obviously with the quest for another Vendée Globe. We'll be following that with interest, and hopefully we can check in with you later in the year for some good news on the Amoca 60 story. But until then, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. I hope you can get some more sleep before you head off again on the Figaro.
That sounds great. Thank you very much.
Well, that's it for this edition of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks to New Zealand solo ocean racer Conrad Coleman for taking the time to talk with me. Thanks also to all of you for listening from wherever you are around the world. So until next time, I'll just say, sail fast, everyone.